Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast. I am Tobeka Dlamini, a candidate attorney in the Pro Bono and Human Rights Department in the Johannesburg office. Today's episode will serve as an introduction to the new series of the Pro Bono and Human Rights Department podcast. Joining me today are two directors, Jackie Cassette, based in the Johannesburg office, and Brigitte Mangale, based in the Cape Town office. Hi, ladies. Thank you for joining me today. Can you just give us a brief introduction on who you are?
Thanks, Tobeka. This is Jackie Cassette. And as you mentioned, I'm indeed a director based here in our Johannesburg office. I'm also the national practice head of CDH's Pro Bono and Human Rights Department, which, as I'll discuss a little bit later, is a distinct practice within the firm. I've had the privilege of heading up this practice for 9 years now. And I think perhaps the best way of answering your question as to who I am in the particular context is to say that I'm a passionate and I think dedicated constitutional and human rights lawyer. And I've been working in the legal sector for a long time now. Some of the roles I've played prior to joining CDH include practicing as an advocate at the Johannesburg Bar for many years. I started out my career lecturing at the University of Witwatersrand Law School for a few years before I went on to do a master's in international human rights law. Thereafter, eventually, I made my way to clerking at the Constitutional Court for Justice Goldstone and then working as a senior investigator at the Public Protector's Office. Just some of the roles that I've played previously to coming to CDH. I love the role I'm playing here at CDH because it enables me to bring together so many of the skill sets that I've acquired over the years in all these different roles in order to make a very real and meaningful impact in the lives of so many.
Tobeka, thanks for your question. Thank you for starting this series. I think it's such an important discussion around some really, really important work that our practice is really dedicated to and that some of our colleagues at our firm also contribute to. Jackie's is a very tough act to follow, so I'm not going to even attempt to suggest that I've had similar experience. This is only my 10th year in practice and my 6th year practicing as a pro bono and human rights lawyer. After completing my LLB, did my articles at another large law firm and immediately got into fee earning litigation. And I quickly realized that, you know, that just wasn't why I studied for an LLB in the first place. And so I went on a bit of a soul searching journey, and I was so fortunate to be approached by CDH to come and build the Cape Town practice. While there was a thriving and well-established practice in Johannesburg, there was nothing close to it in Cape Town. So I consider what I get to do a dream job because I get to onboard matters that not only align with the firm's values, but also align with my personal values. And so with that in mind, my practice focuses on women's rights, children's rights, and land rights matters. And by matters, I mean a range of public interest and impact litigation or project work in communities or anything in between to make some kind of meaningful contribution to those areas of law. I, just like Jackie, am so unbelievably passionate about what I do. I think you kind of have to be when you do this kind of work because it pulls on your heartstrings. It's professionally demanding. You have to really have a sense of calling to do this kind of thing. And that's a sense that Jackie and I share. So it's a privilege and honor to be doing the kind of work that we do.
Thank you so much for that introduction, ladies. I think anyone who knows me knows that ever since I joined the Pro Bono and Human Rights Department, I've actually felt like I'm saving lives. So I do resonate a lot with that. For those who don't necessarily understand or know the kind of work that we do, Jackie, can you please just give us like a brief idea of the work that we do?
Sure, Tobeka. I think that's an important point and question that you ask. I think there are so many, even those within our own firm, who know very little about what it is that we actually do. So this is a wonderful opportunity for us to explore that. And I think to make it known both hopefully to the external world and to people within the firm a little bit more about what it is we do. So just a little bit of context about our practice. So our practice was established by the firm back in 2013, and it was established as a dedicated pro bono and human rights practice. And the reason that the firm chose to do this was in order to make a contribution towards promoting access to justice and to promoting constitutional rights and values. And these are things that the firm does take very seriously and holds very dear. And the work that we do in this practice is really central to the way in which our firm dedicates itself towards being a good corporate citizen and towards promoting these values. So our mandate is to provide pro bono legal assistance to deserving individuals, communities, and non-governmental organizations where appropriate. And inevitably, it's for people who can't afford to pay for legal services or, you know, who would struggle to do so. So our main focus is to onboard and run litigious matters which raise important human rights or constitutional issues and which generally have a broader ripple effect for people and communities across South Africa. Brigitte has already spoken a little bit about some of the focus areas that her practice works on. Here in Johannesburg, we have a slightly different focus area. My practice and that of Algene Ruiz, who is one of our senior associates in the practice, we do a lot of work on the rights of migrants and refugees. Gift, who is our other senior associate, Gift and I have worked on a few matters concerning the rights to education, and we've also been doing some pioneering work in the right to healthcare. And really, I think when I speak to one of our cases dealing with the right to healthcare, I think when you said in the introduction that you literally feel like you're saving lives, well, sometimes we are. And sometimes the work that we are doing is certainly contributing to saving people's lives. And so the work we do is important, it's impactful. And again, I think we can't stress how privileged we feel to being able to make an incredible difference. You know, I don't think that there is anything more meaningful that we could be doing as lawyers, especially to know that we're making a huge and incredible impact in a number of lives.
Thank you for that, Jackie. And without a doubt, I'm sure that everyone now understands what the department does. I can't wait to meet the senior associates who are going to come onto the podcast later on. While we're still on that note, can you maybe share the most memorable pro bono or like human rights matter that you worked on and the overall impact that that case had?
Thanks, Tobeka. So that's quite a difficult question to answer because there have been so many memorable matters that we've been involved in. But I think I'd like to speak to one of the Johannesburg office's most recent really impactful matters, a matter which we refer to as our migrant health matter. This is a case that we worked on for a few years, but which successfully culminated last year. We worked on the matter together with a public interest law center called Section 27 to challenge various unlawful policies, practices, and delegated legislation put in place by the Gauteng Department of Health and which were being used by the department to deny migrant pregnant women and children the free healthcare services that they're entitled to in terms of the National Health Act. Now, as a result of these unlawful practices and policies, many non-South African women and children under the age of 6, including documented asylum seekers, were being denied treatment unless they could pay large sums of money up front. And this denial of treatment has resulted in many tragic consequences. This is all being done, as I've mentioned, in contravention of Section 43 of the National Health Act, which provides that all pregnant and lactating women and children under the age of 6, except, of course, if they are on a medical aid or are beneficiaries of a medical aid, are entitled to free health care in state institutions. Now, just one of the examples of the many tragic consequences that we became aware of this denial of treatment is that of a case that we're actually also dealing with in a matter where an 18-month toddler died after having accidentally ingested rat poison because he was denied emergency admission to a government hospital here in Johannesburg entirely unlawfully. And the reason he was denied admission at the hospital was because his mother didn't have his birth certificate on her. They rushed there on an urgent basis, and because they couldn't pay the 5,000 rand that was demanded of them in order for him to be admitted by the hospital administration. The family or the parents are indigent, unemployed, and they simply didn't have that money. So a young baby boy, a toddler, died as a result of this policy, and he was one of many thousands of people who would have been impacted impacted. What's significant about the case is that we managed to obtain a really wide-ranging order from the Johannesburg High Court, in which not only did the court declare the laws and policies to be unlawful, but it also put in place a number of mandatory orders requiring the minister and the MEC to, for example, issue circulars to all provincial departments and to all medical facilities explaining their obligation to provide free health care to all pregnant women and children under the age of 6, and which also required hospitals and clinics in Gauteng to put up posters in their reception areas explaining the rights that these groups of people have. It also required the department to report back to the court on the steps that taken to implement the order. So a number of supervisory orders were built into the relief. And this has really been quite effective, because from the feedback that we've gotten over the months, we understand that there has really been general compliance with the order and that a number of affected people are now being provided the health care that they're entitled to. And so the impact has really been quite significant.
That was a very impactful matter. I'm just here thinking about what would have happened in the case whereby we didn't pursue that matter. So thank you so much for that, Jackie. Very informative. Now, Brigitte, as an attorney working on a lot of matters, as you've mentioned in your introduction, based on human rights and children's rights and land rights, can you maybe just give us like a brief background on one of the matters that you worked on and had like a really great impact on you as a professional and in the field itself?
Thanks, Tabeka. So I'm going to discuss an ongoing matter that relates to, or that falls under my women's rights focus. And I don't mean to be deliberately cryptic in my discussion of the matter, but I can only say so much because the case is ongoing and I would never want to compromise its progression. That being said, I do want to discuss this particular case because I think it's a really good example of how we do our best to, when clients approach us for assistance, resolve the problem for them, but also to resolve the problem for those who might find themselves in similar circumstances. And that really is at the heart of our public interest impact approach to our litigation. In this matter, we act for the mother and son of a woman who was brutally, brutally murdered by her ex-boyfriend. There had been years and years of extraordinary violence, sexual violence, physical violence, or other forms of mental, financial, and emotional abuse. And this woman was an example of the horrific gender-based violence that our country still struggles with. And she unfortunately became a victim to that extreme gender-based violence. But she also provides an example of how women in our country so often are trapped in their circumstances, both because they have become financially reliant on their partner or because he has broken her down and isolated her so much that she is only left with him as some kind of safe space. So she had no choice but to stay with him for years and years, notwithstanding the abuse. But what's important to note is that on several occasions, she reported the abuse to SAPS. Out of fear for her life, she withdrew the charges on several occasions. But on other occasions, he was simply let out on bail and was able to access her again and repeat his extraordinary violence. What happened in 2018 was that he kidnapped her with the help of his friends, took her to his house and held her captive for 2 days and beat, raped, sexually assaulted her repeatedly. It was when he left the house that she was able to escape and run to the local SAPS, where she had reported his violence many times before. And as a result of his violence against her and his violence in the community, he was very well known by that particular SAPS police station. And that's important to keep in mind for what then ultimately happened. She pressed charges. She was assessed by a medical professional and a report was produced that left no doubt as to the violence that she'd suffered, that she'd been sexually assaulted, and that she was really in a horrific state. SAPS received her in that state. In fact, she arrived at the SAPS police station covered only in a bed sheet. What then happened was that a SAPS official met with her again and said, "I will be away at a course for 2 weeks. I will leave it in your hands to trace him yourself and to then report again to SAPS so that another member of that particular SAP station can find him and arrest him. I'm sure the listeners will appreciate that is a gross failing on SAPS's part for several reasons. There was simply no missing information where SAPS is concerned that prevented them from effecting the arrest immediately. And so off this SAPS official goes, and in that time, the deceased ended up withdrawing the charges once again out of fear for her life. And so he remained a free man. Months later, he found her again and beat her to death. And it was only when his neighbor saw him digging a shallow grave for her body that he'd kept under his bed for 2 days that it was reported, the community was up in arms and demanded that SAPS do something about the situation. And so while that is an awful story, it is an extreme example of violence. It's heartbreakingly a situation that many women in our country find themselves in. And so the case that we've brought is one on behalf of, as I've said, the deceased's mother and son, where we seek delictual damages against the Minister of Police for his vicarious liability for the SAPS official's failures to adequately protect her, to effect an arrest, and to otherwise comply with the constitutional obligations to serve their communities. But those delictual damages fall hopelessly short of providing some kind of appropriate financial compensation for the mother and son. I don't mean to ever suggest that any sum of money could serve as true justice. But even then, the sum of money that we can sensibly and lawfully claim just falls hopelessly short of adequate compensation. And so what we've then pulled together, which is a claim that is relatively new in our law in terms of how it's been brought to our courts, is a claim for constitutional damages. And that claim speaks directly to the SAPS official's constitutional obligation to protect members of their immediate community, an obligation that is only heightened in the context of our country's gender-based violence statistics. And that sum of money is claimed in two parts. It is a sum of money that we propose be paid directly to mother and son, but there is also a sum of money that we propose be paid over to a local women's shelter in the area in which this violence occurred, so that they can extend their capacity to keep women safe in these circumstances. Because as I mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, she was trapped. She just simply had no other place to go. And there are several women's shelters that were local to her that simply didn't have space for her and didn't have capacity. And so this is a good example of the kind of litigation we run, where we recognize that where a client comes to you, they are almost always not in an entirely unique position, and it provides you an opportunity to slowly but surely make a contribution toward supporting the horrific circumstances that so many in our country have to face on a daily basis.
Now, looking at our country's status quo, it only makes sense for us to be involved in such matters and provide support and resources and advocacy for survivors and even the kin, the survivors. I can't imagine how it is to deal with such matters on almost a daily basis, whereby we're advocating for people who fell victim to such matters. Now, what I think I'd like to know, and I know our listeners would love to know this as well, is what is the ideal way, the ideal manner of approaching human rights cases that involve such sensitivity and such controversy as well? Like, how do you go about, you know, dealing with or even handling such matters?
You know, in preparing to answer this question, I had an immediate response and I said to myself, well, isn't that quite obvious? And where I immediately landed thereafter was that unfortunately, it's not, you know, immediately apparent that this is the sensible approach to take. And that approach is to recognize that while our job is to be good lawyers and to be on top of legal developments and to use the law to protect and support our clients, at the outset, where we must begin our engagements with our clients is recognizing that there is a real life behind this very interesting legal matter. And it just made me reflect on the fact that when anyone is coming to a lawyer, whether it's about a commercial dispute or a gender-based violence matter or a healthcare matter, they are overwhelmed by their circumstances. They are confused. They may be scared. And they are saying to you, I can't fix this problem on my own. I need your help. And so just constantly reminding yourself, and thankfully, because we're so dedicated to what we do, that reminding doesn't sort of have to be switched on. It's just sort of in the back of our minds constantly. But just making sure that you never forget that there is a human being who is terrified, overwhelmed, scared, and you then have an enormous responsibility to make them feel safe with you, to tell you all the things that went wrong and that they may even have done wrong in contributing to where they find themselves. And then to just handle that with care and kindness and compassion and patience and understanding before you bombard them with an overly complicated legal solution, which many of our cases necessitate, because as Jackie and I have said, our approach is to fix the problem for the client, but also see what we can do to create some kind of ripple effect to create a long-lasting solution that extends beyond our client. A high professional standard and dedication is built in and is our approach at every instance and at every step of the matter, no matter how big or small. This profession is meant to be one of honor, one of service, and one of humility. And so as a good lawyer, particularly a good public interest lawyer, understanding that you are in a position of service and you are holding a real person's real lived experience is just the bare minimum in engaging with the kind of matters that we do and engaging with the kind of clients that we do.
Thank you for that, Brigitta. Yes, this is the life of a public interest lawyer, where you're passionate and where passion stops its dedication and where dedication ceases to exist, then you need to be professional. And I think it's very important to outline that the interests of the clients always comes first. And thank you so much for that, Brigitta. So over the next couple of weeks, the Pro Bono and Human Rights Department will be releasing a series of podcasts. Jackie, do you want to maybe share a bit of light on what can our listeners expect from these episodes?
Yeah, sure, Tabeka. So I think what we've been clear already just from everything that we've discussed and dealt with already in this podcast, many of our matters are complex, long histories, are dealing with really important, interesting issues, and it's really impossible to explore them all in one podcast. So the purpose of this podcast really is an introduction, I think, to our practice, to the work we do, to also, you know, just highlight the way in which our practice works. So over the next few weeks or months, the plan is to roll out and record a number of other podcasts where we focus in more specifically on the cases we're dealing with and a range of different cases where we've actually achieved a success and we feel like we've done something really important in fixing a situation and taking the rights of classes of people forward. And, you know, each is going to require, I think, a podcast in and of itself to really do justice to the matters that we'd like to speak to. And the reason, again, why we want to do this and why, in fact, Tabeka, this was your idea, this series of podcasts, so thank you, is really, I think, to emphasize, you know, the nature of the work that we're doing, to make it public for people to understand the work that we do and the significance of what we're doing, not just externally, as I mentioned, but also internally. And part of that is also going to invite members in other practice areas, some of our fee-earning practitioners who are also doing some incredible and important pro bono work in their own rights and in their own capacities, and to offer them an opportunity also just to speak to the important work that they're doing.
Yes, it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks. I really cannot wait to hear more about the work that the Pro Bono and Human Rights Department deals with, especially seeing that most people would expect that Cliff Dekhoffmeyer only deals with commercial matters. Speaking of that, Brigitta, can we expect to hear from anyone else outside the department, or is this specifically for the Pro Bono and Human Rights Department?
No, it's not. And that's one of the really cool things about our firm, is that it recognizes the importance and the value that our department adds, given that we are a dedicated pro bono and human rights unit. But it also encourages our colleagues to take on pro bono matters where their unique expertise can be put to good use. So one can appreciate that not all matters that are meant to be resolved in the public interest will narrowly raise constitutional issues that Jackie and I would be best placed to speak to. Many issues fall under the umbrella of commercial or real estate. And so what I expect we'll hear in the next episodes in the series is from our colleagues in our commercial practice areas, our real estate practice areas, and our dispute resolution practice areas. And depending on how long this podcast will run, we may well have an opportunity to hear from some other practitioners in our employment practice, for example, and other areas in our firm to show how their unique expertise is put to good use and is used to serve members of some really vulnerable communities.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, the next couple of weeks are actually going to be the most interesting for me. I know I'm definitely looking forward to those episodes. I'm looking forward to hearing all the stories that, you know, are always, you know, behind the scenes and people don't really know about them. Ladies, thank you so much for your time. And I guess I'll see you guys next time.
Thanks, Tobeka.
Thanks, Tobeka.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.